talking about the conflict in Ukraine, about these JASSMs, and we know that they can hit the target within the 300 to 300 kilometers. It seems that with these upgraded systems, they can hit to 900 kilometers, which is huge, a huge difference. Is that how does Russia perceive this, Scott?
Russia's made its position quite clear. If any of these weapons are used against Russian soil, Russia will immediately retaliate against the source of this. And the source means not just where the weapon was launched, but who provided the weapons. Anatoly Antonov made it clear to the United States prior to his departure to Russia that this includes striking the United States, the continental United States, with nuclear weapons. So, I mean, there we are. I mean, there's really no guessing here. I don't know why we keep doing stupidity of this nature, because all we're doing is Ukraine has lost this war. No amount of weaponry can change that outcome. The collapse in the Donetsk front is real. It's happening. The Russians are just advancing. I mean, you had to, don't take my word for it, take the word of, I think his commander of the 54th or 57th Brigade in the Ukrainian army says, we're losing 7 miles a day. We're just withdrawing 7 miles a day every day, going backwards and backwards and backwards. We got nothing left to stand up. We don't have any infantry. We're out of artillery. We're out of tanks. We have nothing. And so they're falling back. The Kursk salient is collapsing. Russia is building up forces. Russia is getting ready for a winter offensive. Ukraine can't survive the winter. 90% of their thermal electrical production capability is destroyed and will not be rebuilt. And if Russia, has its way, maybe Russia will destroy the remaining 10%, which means Ukraine will freeze to death over the winter. Politically, socially, economically, they can't survive this winter. That will carry on into the spring, where you're going to see, if they don't collapse in the winter, the total collapse in the spring. There's nothing Ukraine can do about this. This is what attrition warfare does. So we're going to give them a handful of JASSM missiles, put them on F-16s that can barely take off without being blown up, and hope to change the course of the war. All we're going to do is that Russia guarantee that Russia will strike back, and Russia's strike will be decisive. Is NATO ready for that? Does NATO have the capability? We'll find out. They're doing a exercise of their nuclear potential right now. And who knows? NATO may need to use that pretty soon, because Russia is going to take NATO out if NATO allows Ukraine to use these weapons to strike deep inside Russia.
Whenever we talk about Ukraine, Scott, in the comment section, we see people are talking about, Scott was talking about that Ukraine is defeated. It's been 2 years that Scott is talking about this. But it seems that they do have the same kind of mindset that we are witnessing in the NATO countries. In their mind, there is no point of defeat. It seems that as long as there is a Ukrainian, there is Ukrainian people on that land, they want to sacrifice all of them in order to show that they're not defeated. Because you can mobilize people right and left and send them to the battlefield to be slaughtered by this Russian army. And
Well,
how we can understand them, Scott?
I don't try to understand comments of ignorant people. I'm more than happy to engage in a in a fact-based analysis of this. I will freely say that I thought when Russia made the decision to go into Ukraine that it was war. And I believe that had Russia gone to war against Ukraine, that implies all aspects of its strategic air campaign, full-scale ground offensive operations designed to close with and destroy the enemy through firepower and maneuver, that Ukraine could not stand this, that they would be done within a week. It wasn't just me that thought that. General Milley briefed Congress, the chairman of the CIA briefed Congress. This was the understanding of everybody who knew anything about Russia. But what nobody expected is that Russia wasn't running a war. They were running a special military operation that was designed to achieve a political outcome, that is, to compel Ukraine through the force of arms to the negotiating table, so that this war could be brought to a rapid end. Again, find me one person that said that's what Russia's doing. No one said that. And so, if I thought one thing was happening, something else was happening. And it took a while to realize that. And then you adapt to it. You say, okay, this is what Russia is doing. Now, the thing about being a professional analyst is that your job is to continually evaluate what's going on. And then as new information comes in, you adapt to this new information, you come up with new assessments. So I find it sort of curious when people want to be critical. So when they see an assessment that I might make in April, they say, yeah, but back in February, you said a week, but it's April. Things move. You know, I did this for a living, guys. I did it in wartime. I did it during the Cold War. I did it in peacetime. I did it in Iraq. The target moves. You do an assessment based upon the information you have. You try to make short-term, mid-term, and long-term, predictive analysis. Very rarely, I mean, strategically, some things are easy. Strategically, Russia was never going to lose this war. All right. And anybody who believes otherwise, just look at the game board, guys. The game went on longer than anybody thought it would, but Russia was never in danger of losing this war. What happened is that NATO and the United States committed to Ukraine to the extent that Ukraine now is in the fourth iteration of its army. Russia's won this war four times. They've destroyed the Ukrainian army four times, but we keep rebuilding it. We're at the point right now where we can't rebuild it. It's fatally crippled. There are no manpower. I mean, you're pulling kids screaming out of discotheques or ball games or whatever to go fight. What kind of motivation do they have? We're down to, desperately believing that some JASSM missiles are going to change the outcome on the battlefield. It's not. Ukraine's economy is a wreck. So strategically, I've always said that Russia will win this war. Ukraine will never win this war. I think I'm right on that. In the midterm, I always said that Russia has the strategic and tactical advantage, that they're doing things right, that economically Russia is prevailing, the sanctions won't work against Russia. I think I was right on that one. That Putin will be strengthened politically because of this conflict. I think I was right on that one. That the European economy will collapse because of this conflict. I think I'm right on that one. That America will have political difficulties because of this conflict. I think I'm right on that one, guys. How am I doing so far? You see, if we reverse it, if we come at it from the other end of the spectrum. But now we come down to the tactical aspects of this. I admit, I said it would be a week. It wasn't. Why? Well, Russia didn't go to war. It was a special military operation. But what Russia did do is within 6 days of initiating this conflict, the one that you're all sitting there going, Ukraine's winning, Ukraine's winning. Then why did Ukraine run to the negotiating table in Gomel? Why? Because they were getting slaughtered on the battlefield. Yes, Russia made mistakes. Yes, Russian troops went in too deep, didn't have flank protection, and the Ukrainians were able to ambush certain convoys. But overall, Russia crushed the Ukrainian military, was inflicting casualties that Ukraine could not sustain, and Ukraine knew this, so they went to the negotiating table and agreed in the end of March to terms of conflict termination that met all of Russia's requirements. A victorious party doesn't concede this like they did unless they're losing on the battlefield, which they were. That's the reality of it. Then what happened? NATO and the United States made a strategic decision that they wouldn't let Ukraine collapse. And so they said, we're going to rebuild your military. And so we began the new Lend-Lease program. That's a game-changing event. Who, when the war started, again, all you geniuses out there, all you analysts out there, who said, yeah, on my bingo card, the United States is going to give Ukraine $48 billion in May. Did you really predict that? None of you did. None of you did. It took everybody by surprise. And they went, whoa, this is a game-changing event. I myself said this is a game-changing event because if they inject $48 billion into this conflict, it gives Ukraine sustainability that it didn't have. Plus, NATO provides strategic depth. Another thing I brought up, now, if you want to take Ukrainians out of Ukraine and train them in Germany and France and England and elsewhere, equip them and then bring them back in, Ukraine has the ability to build a military capacity that can't be touched by Russia under the current rules. Now, what Russia did while they were rebuilding is begin the offensive. They recaptured Lugansk. They made good strides into Donetsk. They moved into Kharkov. They were doing well. Battle of Mariupol. They made the land bridge. All these things that Russia did, winning, by the way. I just want to point that out. But then in the negotiation, Russia agreed to, as a good faith measure, to withdraw from Ukraine. They said, in exchange for peace on our terms, we don't want to hold on to territory. We're going to give you Kherson back. We're going to give you Zaporizhia back. We're going to withdraw from Kiev. We're going to withdraw from all these areas. That's what we agreed. And they started to do it. Then that new NATO army, the second iteration, launched an attack, took advantage of the fact that Russians had withdrawn, that Russians weren't focused on defending against these kinds of attacks. And they had great success in Kharkiv. They took the right bank of Kherson. They pushed the Russians back. And then Russia had to change the way. Again, how many people can say that you thought that in September of 2022 that Russia would do two things? One, a referendum to absorb four new territories into Russia. That's totally different than what Russia talked about when they started the conflict. It's not in keeping with the Russian negotiating position that led up to the Istanbul communique of 1 April, wasn't part of this. Russia changed things. So it's a game-changing event. You see that term, guys? You have a game-changing event. You know what happens when you have a game-changing event? You have to sort of take back and take a new assessment of what's going on. So for all the people that sit there and say, well, Ritter in the fall of 2022 is saying X, and that difference is different than what he was saying in May, because the game changed, you morons. Again, I don't understand. You're trying to score cheap political points by, making statements of the obvious. The game changed, and so professional analysts change with it. Now we had to deal with Russia mobilizing 300,000 troops. We had to deal with Russia reinvigorating their defense industry. We had to, incorporate what happens when Ukraine suffers all those losses, that $48 billion we poured in, and they all die, which they did. You don't get Kharkiv and Kherson for free. You ran into a Russian defense that smothered you. So we rebuilt the army a third time. Do you guys remember this? The third time. And this one was so predictable. Why? Well, the Ukrainians made it easy. You remember the interviews Zelensky gave to The Economist in December of 2022? He said, we need 12 brigades. Oh, wow, thank you there, pal. And we're going to attack, to sever the land bridge. And we're going to attack through Tokmak to Melitopol. So he just gave you the number of forces and the direction of advance. Meanwhile, we have a battle for Bakhmut taking place, which nobody predicted, not even the Russians. They didn't want it. The Ukrainians didn't want it. It was Prigozhin that imposed this on everybody, this meat grinder operation that changed dynamic. It disrupted the Russians. It disrupted the Ukrainians in this major meat grinder. Nobody predicted that Prigozhin would go rogue. How many of you guys predicted that? I certainly didn't. I didn't predict that he'd go rogue. Is that an analytical failure? Perhaps. But that's the reality that happened there. The Ukrainians, launched their vaunted summer counteroffensive that they had predicted. Meanwhile, Russia had prepared for it. And I predicted this. I straight out said, go back in June. I said, this is exactly what's going to happen. The Ukrainians didn't make any headway. They ran into the Russian defenses, and the Russians chewed them up, spit them out, and wiped out the third army. So now we have to build a fourth army for the Ukrainians. And that's the one that's dying right now. This fourth army had certain forces, Abrams tanks, Chieftain tanks, modern Leopard tanks, all come in. They created a 20 to 30,000 strategic reserve that was held back there to keep Kiev safe. Meanwhile, on the front line, though, they didn't have too many forces. And I said, Russia is now going to get into a war of attrition and wear them down, grind them down. And Russia has been doing that. And now we had the Ukrainians commit their strategic reserves into Kursk. Nobody predicted that. You guys predicted? I didn't. I didn't see that coming. I admit it. No one saw it coming because it makes no sense. You don't sit there and go, oh, they got strategic reserve. You have a declining situation in Donetsk. Logically speaking, they're going to use a strategic reserve as a fire brigade to plug the gaps, to hold the Russians back, to buy time, to inflict more casualties on the Russians, et cetera. Nope. Screw the people in Donetsk. Send the strategic reserve into Kursk, where they're all going to die. Over 23,000 of them had died so far, along with hundreds of tanks and everything. Basically, they're done. In order to preserve whatever they have left, they've had to put even more reinforcements there, taking troops away from the Donetsk front, causing the collapse. For all you guys out there that want to pick on things, all I would ask you to do is, if you're going to criticize me based upon the predictions I made during the specific windows. But if you're going to sit there and say that, in phase two, Ritter said this, but in phase three, this is what happened. That's pretty dishonest and disingenuous of you. But again, it just proves that you're not really professional analysts. You're here as trolls and you're trying to, to generate a response, which you did. Congratulations. But there's the thing. Russia has won this war. Russia's not going to lose this war. And there's nothing NATO, the United States, Ukraine, or the trolls can do to change that outcome.
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you.
It seems that the Zelensky administration is talking about negotiations, but it's so amazing that the Yermak is talking about we're going to negotiate, but not with Putin. With Putin, we're not, and we want to negotiate with someone else. Putin is the president of Russian Federation. How it's ridiculous. It's something from elementary school. It's
Well, that's what they are. This is, first of all, again, it's just a game that's being played right now to for Zelensky to maintain some sort of political credibility domestically and on the international stage. This is like Hitler saying that I'll negotiate in April of 1945, I'll negotiate the surrender of the Soviet Union, but not with Stalin. Anybody but Stalin. And you think Stalin's going to go, damn, too bad for me. I've got to resign. I've got to step down. I mean, come on, Voroshilov, Zhukov, somebody come. Molotov, come in, take my place. Hitler doesn't want to negotiate with me. Oh, no. Do you think Putin loses any sleep over that? You think, I would doubt anybody actually briefs him on this. I mean, he may come across it, but I mean, at some point in time, Lavrov and Gerasimov and, Belousov have to basically just say Zelensky's just a distraction. He's irrelevant. And they've already factored him out. He's not, they don't care what he says. Putin gave him a chance back in June. He put on a deal on the table, which is a continuation of the April 2022 Istanbul communique. He said, look, all those terms are still in, adjusted for the new reality that we own four territories that you're never going to get back. But all the other terms are in play. This is the best deal you're ever going to have. Take it now and the war can end. And Zelensky opted out of it, doubled down on stupid, began the Kursk operation. Again, for the people here who don't know Russia and don't understand Russian history, you do understand that Kursk is sacred ground. You are familiar with the Battle of Kursk, the turning point in the Second World War, and it is sacred ground, holy land, holy soil for the Russians. And for the Ukrainians to strike into Kursk from Sumy, fighting on the same ground that this battle was fought on in 1943, the insult to Russia is beyond comprehension in the West. It would be, I'm trying to come up with the equivalent. It would be as if the Mexican immigrants decided to assault the Alamo and burn the Alamo down. Texans would say, "That's it, done, finished." Battle of Gettysburg. If somebody decided that they were going to assault through Gettysburg and take out the Gettysburg battlefield, I think Americans would say, "That's no, we're not going to let that happen." The Russians are looking at what the Ukrainians did at Kursk. And it's again, it's not just Ukraine. NATO invaded. This was a NATO invasion, a NATO planned operation. You saw two German generals get up on national TV in Germany and show the map. And I mean, with their sick, stupid German accents, they couldn't have picked two guys that look more like Nazis than those two to sit there and replay this. And they were like, we're familiar with this. We've done this before. We've been, I mean, they're openly talking about how cool it is to have German tanks back in Kursk. I mean, this is a sickness. This is a disease. But Russia will never forgive Ukraine for this. Russia will, in the West, we're like, well, it's okay. It's just an incursion. It's not a big deal. Russia will never forgive Ukraine. And the other thing I asked people to do, and it came across when I visited there. I mean, I did pay a short visit to the four new territories. When you get into, especially the Donbas, there's memorials everywhere. you know, we tend to forget that the Russian reconquest of the Donbass from Nazi Germany was a, it took a period of time, and it was very bloody, very, very bloody fighting. And that the miners working with the Red Army kept Russia going, because the miners are still pulling the coal out to feed the Russian economy, the Soviet economy. The Red Army is fighting. They work together. They collaborate together. And there's monuments all over the place that show this. You know, even in you go to Donetsk, the one of the big monuments there is about the Second World War. You go to Azovstal, there's a big monument about, you know, the workers in the Red Army together before all of this. That is part of the history here. And for Ukraine to basically come in and tear down these memorials, deface these memorials, disgrace these memorials, it's unforgivable. And again, in the West, we tend not even to reflect on this. We're like, well, we don't even know about this. The Russian people are so insulted by what Ukraine has done, what the Ukrainians have done to their collective history, because the Russians, again, are like, this is your history, guys. Back then, you were on the good side, except for the Banderists. You were with us. These monuments are your monuments. And yet you're defacing them. You're disgracing them. You're disgracing the sacrifice made by 27 million people in, you know, achieving the liberation of Russia, of the Soviet Union from Nazi Germany. We don't have a clue what's going through the minds of the Russians. If we did, we'd be scared to death, because they are so united in their insistence that this war doesn't end until the Ukraine that existed on February 23rd, 2022, no longer exists. Now, physically, Ukraine will look like something. But what they're talking about is that the political structures that were in Ukraine, these pro-NATO, pro-EU, pro-Banderist elements, they will be eradicated. They will be eliminated. They will be finished. They will not be allowed to exist. And the Russians, again, they know their history. This is not the first time the Banderists have risen up to bite them. You know, they understand the history of the Banderists. They understand what happened during Nazi occupation. They understand the collaboration, the murder. They understand what happened between 1945 and 1954, the ongoing fighting. They understand that what happened when they were released by Khrushchev and the reintegration, the diaspora, the money pouring in, the CIA pouring in. They understand the role played by the Banderists in leading up to the 2014 coup d'etat in Kiev. And they understand what the Banderists tried to do in Crimea and failed successfully in Mariupol, the rape of Mariupol, the Russians in Mariupol, physical rape by the Banderists. The Azov battalion was born there in Mariupol. They understand what these people have done to the Donbass, and they will never be given a second chance. When Ukraine embraces Stepan Bandera as the father of Ukraine, that means that that Ukraine must die. And that's where the Russians are. So all the supporters out there, when you're talking about, when you hear, you know, Zelensky's going, we're going to negotiate, we're talking about negotiating, we're talking about this, you don't get to negotiate. You're done. Russia, Putin gave you a chance. Now you failed, and your Nazi regime, your Nazi-supporting regime is going to be eliminated, eradicated. Whatever emerges, I believe, will have nothing to do with the present regime. It'll be a new Ukrainian government, which will have to revise the constitution to outlaw the Banderism. We'll see. Now, what's going to happen to Western Ukraine and all this? Lvov, I see somebody type that in there. That's a fair question. You know, but, you know, is Russia going to return Western Ukraine, reverse Stalin's decision of incorporating what was, you know, Polish territory, or at one time Polish territory? I guess at some point in time, there's always some Polish territory, Lithuanian territory, Russian territory. They've been going back and forth in that area. That's why Timothy Snyder rightly calls it the Bloodlands. The rest of his analysis is crap, but it's true. It's blood-soaked soil. What happens to that? I don't know. It's a Russian decision. It's a Russian decision. But I think whatever happens before it gets turned over to whatever, and I don't, you know, I could see Russia giving it to Poland, because I don't see the Poles allowing Banderism to revive after Volyn massacre, et cetera. But before that happens, I think the Russians are going to make sure that every Banderist is either in prison, dead, or in exile, that there will be no physical manifestation of Banderism in post-conflict Ukraine. It must come to an end. It must be eradicated. And then, you know, the decision could be made as to what happens to the physical territory of Western Ukraine. Do you give it to Poland? Does Belarus incorporate it? Do you split it up? Does it remain part of Ukraine? These are political questions that, you know, I don't have the answer to right now. Maybe some of the trolls can come back at me in a couple months and say, well, Scott Ritter said this, that, the other thing. I don't care.
The German intelligence chief, Bruno Kohl, warned that Russia may be capable of attacking NATO by the end of the decade. And when you see someone as high as this guy's head of intelligence in Germany talking this way, Scott, do they really believe that Russia would do that?
Because no. This is politicized intelligence designed to justify NATO's continued existence. That's it. Look, a military professional would understand this. Russia today has between 700 and 900,000 forces operating in the special military operation area. They might be able to surge this up to over a million. That million will be hard pressed to continue this advance that's going on right now, and expanding it to, instance, some of the things that people talk about, the total reconquest of Kharkov, maybe the conquest of Sumy or parts of Sumy, and the conquest of Odessa to create a land bridge to Transnistria. That million may not be enough to do that. So they might need even more troops to do that. And that's going to be stressful to Russia to come up with more troops. That's expensive, et cetera. How do you take this reality and then say Russia is going to attack NATO? I mean, Russia can defend against NATO. That's a different question altogether. Because NATO now, you know, the idea of attacking Russia, you know, we hear talk NATO is going to have 300,000 troops, maybe come up to 500,000 troops. NATO would have to have about 2 million troops to be able to successfully attack Russia. So then they don't have that. They don't have the ability to generate that. Russia would need similar number of forces to attack NATO. They don't have it. Plus, there's no political will. Russia has no desire. There's no advantage for Russia to attack NATO. Russia's defeating NATO as it speaks. If Russia allows things to go its own way, NATO may very well dissolve within a decade. That's just a statement of fact. There are deep fissures inside NATO. We just talked earlier about Turkey, and Turkey is making a hardcore press to join BRICS. If Turkey joins BRICS, how much longer is Turkey in NATO for? And if Turkey leaves NATO, what happens to other nations that are also finding themselves on the outside of European Union, unity? What happens to Hungary? What happens to Slovakia? These are nations that could easily leave the European Union, head to BRICS, and in doing so, jump ship and see the dissolution of NATO. What happens to other nations when they realize that this is insane, that NATO's gone insane? Germany, for instance. So what happens when Scholz is finally relieved and a new German government comes in that finds NATO policies incompatible with German existential survival? And the Germans make a decision to if not jump ship, at least assume a more neutral posture. This is the reality. So this is insanity. First of all, these are German generals fighting for a budget. In the last budget, the German budget, there was a problem. Pistorius, the defense minister, asked for certain increases. If you remember, Germany had, after Russia invaded, talked about investing 100 billion euro into the revitalization of the German military. They did that, and the German military didn't get revitalized because it was so sick. It was so decrepit. It was so broken that it simply couldn't. They ran out of money. So now they're talking about sustaining this growth factor. And so they asked for more money so they can continue doing some of the work that the 100 billion was supposed to do, create this new brigade in Lithuania and do some other things. And what the parliament came back with was a very modest increase that didn't even meet inflation. So basically this actual spending power of the German military shrunk, which means that instead of expanding, the German military is going to have to shrink as well. And this is the reality going forward. The German economy is in recession, heading towards depression. They have no excess money. They can't meet these defense expenditures. And so this is what's behind statements by this German general. It's about generating fear to justify increased defense budgets at a time when society is saying that's not our priority. There are other priorities, like restoring the health of the German industrial sector, to make sure that Germany doesn't bleed off jobs, to keep Volkswagen from closing, things of this nature.
Before wrapping up, Scott, this talk, how do you find the situation with Taiwan right now? It seems that China is encircling Taiwan. And what's the fear of China, and what's in their mind right now?
China is looking at a new Taiwanese president who's been very aggressive in his his desire to see Taiwanese independence. And I think he is, there's a political struggle because the Chinese parliament, the president's party didn't win the governing majority there. In fact, the other two parties have the majority. So there's parliamentary blocks to the executive. So the executive has to, do what he can through declaratory measures, et cetera, to posture in order to get, American support and be seen as doing things. And the Chinese are just fed up with it. They're fed up with his rhetoric, which they find to be very dangerous. And there's just sending a signal. And they went out and did an exercise that basically said, we can strangle you to death anytime we want to. And the other thing that Taiwan has to look at is that, the only other nation out there that has missiles capable of firing sustained saturation attacks against limited targets is Chinese against Taiwan. And I think the Taiwanese also have to look at if, the day of saying we're going to beat the Chinese on the beach, they're going to come across and we're going to sink their ships, and any guys that come on in, we're going to hold them and can't push them back into the ocean, is over. China will strangle you economically, then China will destroy you militarily using ballistic missiles, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. You can't defend yourself. The American missile shield doesn't work. Then once you're crushed to a certain level where your level of your political will to resist and society's political will to resist is collapsed, then China will come in with overwhelming force that you can't stop, and they will occupy the island. That's the way the next war works. The United States will attempt to stop it. We'll send ships in. They'll get sunk. We'll send airplanes in. They'll get shot down. And then it could get interesting. We could decide then, now that you sank a U.S. aircraft carrier, that we're going to launch a nuclear strike against the home port of the Chinese forces that sank the air carrier. And we nuke them. And now the Chinese nuke us, and wham, they get into a nice little nuclear exchange, which, if we're going to strike China, we have to fire either missiles coming again over the North Pole, over Russia. Russia's not going to respond well to that, or fire Trident missiles at a depressed trajectory. But again, the second the Trident missile is launched, the launch zone in the Pacific is very similar to the launch zone that Russia would use, that the United States would use to strike Russian targets. To have missiles fly to Western China to strike is the same flight profile as striking the Russian missile belt, across the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And Russia will just assume that it's a tech launch on warning, general nuclear war, we all die. So that's what's going on with Taiwan.